attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Christian Edwards. Before the Kardashians started posting and influences were a thing, Christian was tweeting under the mystery name of West End Producer. He rapidly gained a cult following, putting noses out of joint with his satirical take on the world of theatre. A whirlwind of creativity, for 14 years he inhabited the Dom Swilling secret identity, appearing in real life at first nights, authoring books, writing regular articles in The Stage, and producing and starring in sellout shows on the West End and Edinburgh Fringe, always punctuated with the hashtag dear. Then in theatre's greatest Scooby-Doo moment, Christian revealed his identity as the man behind the mask, bringing to an end one of the West End's most successful and unique theatrical runs. Christian says, "I was just frustrated with the industry as a whole, and I just wanted to put a lighter voice out there because it can be taken very seriously, the acting industry. But really, we're just standing on stage, shouting in the right direction, and trying to make people stop coughing." Welcome to the show, Christian Edwards.
Hi, Giles. How are you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, it's great to talk. Great to talk.
Yeah, yeah.
Seven quick fires for you, Christian, starting with Dom or Vuv?
Oh, Dom, dear. It has to be Dom.
Macintosh or Lloyd Webber?
Oh, they both employ me, so I'm going to go Mac Webber.
Comedy or tragedy?
Oh, it's a tragic life, but I'm going to say comedy, dear.
Christian Edwards or West End Producer?
Oh, fucking... Christian Edwards. I've got to say Christian Edwards now.
Yeah, you got to.
I've got to.
I've got three more. X or Twitter?
Twitter. It was easier then.
Oliver or Les Mis?
No, we're going to go with Les Mis because that's what I did most recently.
Amazing. And then finally, slightly unfairly, everything you always wanted to know about acting but were afraid to ask, dear, or everything you always wanted to know about going to the theatre but were too sloshed to ask, dear?
Everything you always wanted to know about acting, because I'm still trying to find out everything I always want to know about acting, basically, yeah. But, thanks for that, Giles. That's a nice little plug for my two books there. That's very kind. I appreciate it.
There we go. We'll come on to that for sure, for sure. Now, listen, Christian, to start the show, we always ask every guest about their path to where they are now and find that it's rarely a linear one. How did it all start for you? What was your first ever job? And then what was your first, what you regard to be proper job?
Well, my first ever job, I did loads of stuff in Lincoln, where I'm originally from, having to, I worked at Walker's Crisp Factory on the night shift, helping make quavers with the post-mix things. I've never touched quavers since. I'd get home at 7 o'clock in the morning stinking of cheese. It's horrid. As an actor, you do so much in between work. You know, there's tragic tales of me dressed as a giant cigarette at Victoria Station and then running around to people who were smoking outside and handing out Nicorette patches and coughing at them and then being caught by the cigarette police. This was an absolutely true story. And actually, to give it a bit of a tragic, going back to those questions context, I was meant to get married many years ago, and the girl that I was meant to marry, sadly, we didn't. She ended it a month before the wedding. The last time I saw her was 2 months before I did that job. And then there she was walking past me as I was a giant cigarette. And I thought, there's no way she's going to recognize me. And she turned around and she went, "Christian?" And I was like, "Yeah, hi, are you all right?" And she went, "Yeah, how are you doing?" And I was like, I'm all right. I'm doing all right. Thanks. Yeah. She wandered off and I was like, oh, fuck. And then my manager came up and said, "Do you want a break?" And then cue to me, stood outside Victoria Station, dressed as a giant cigarette, having a fag. It was ridiculous.
She wasn't smoking, was she, when she walked past?
No, she wasn't. She wasn't. Otherwise, I'd have thrown a load of Nicorette patches at her. Yeah, I've done lots of silly jobs like that. But I suppose my first proper job in terms of, I suppose acting would have been a UK tour of something called Rasputin many years ago. Oh, actually, no, before that was a four-hour version of Emma, where the director, a lovely lady, but she was going to bed, sharing intimate bedtimes with the writer. So this four-hour version of Emma couldn't be edited. So we'd be doing places like Westcliff-on-Sea to us to about 14 OAPs. And again, that's questioning my life choices. And I have been ever fucking since. Anyway, yes, but that was my first kind of, that was like acting role where I thought, oh, this is going to be really good and I'm going to change. I think what happens with the actors, you leave and you think you're going to change the world. You're going to be Bradley Pitt in a year's time, or at least get a guest role on Hollyoaks.
And growing up, did you always want to be an actor? Like, at what stage did you identify acting as the route you wanted to follow?
Well, it was a weird one. To be honest, I think I didn't really fit in. I was I'm a ginger, Giles. I'm a ginger. And at drama school, I was an easy
child. A proud ginger.
I am. I'm a proud ginger. I was, it's getting to the stage where it's getting a little bit white at the moment. And I'm thinking, I need to get some fucking red hair dye so that at least I can hold on to my identity. So I was bullied, obviously, a lot. Carrot Top, Duracell, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. As a kid, and I think I only found my footing when I got into, you know, the school plays, and I got a bit of respect. I gave the seminal performance of Joseph and his amazing ginger raincoat in Lincoln. I suppose I just found some mates there and I fitted in a bit more.
Nice. So Emma was the first role you took on.
Yeah.
And how did it go? I mean, it didn't sound great from your brief summary, but was it a launch pad of sorts?
It was a launch pad. I mean, you know, I went to drama school. I went to a place called Mountview in North London, where actually I went with your colleague, Gasp, Stuart Savitsky, the legend, yeah, that is Stuart, and we trained together. So you kind of go to a drama school and you get your agent from there. It's a way of getting an agent and getting your foot into the business, really. But and then Emma was, God, it was... When you first leave a drama school, you kind of do any work that you can, because it's very different in the industry. Because a drama school, I suppose, like a university, is like an institution, isn't it? So you feel very institutionalized. There's the favorites there that get all the leading roles, and I did all right. I had a few there, but I didn't have the best time at drama school. I found it quiet. I think I was too young. I went straight after I'd done my A levels, and I think I spent the first few years trying to fit in and plucking up the courage to speak to women. So it took me a long time to kind of just to put my head down. But once I graduated, you kind of take any work. And Emma was good. Emma was good. But again, it was just full of ridiculous moments. I remember the girl playing Emma, she had tooth poisoning one day. So she walked off stage during the first bit where we were all sat around in a circle and vomited in the wings. And it was very clear that she was vomiting backstage. And then the guy playing the leading role anyway, so I said, ladies and gentlemen, it's very clear that our leading actress is ill, so we're going to close the curtains and see what we can do. And then they put on the wig's mistress with a script who we pushed around the stage saying the lines she'd never acted in her life. But actually, in terms of PR and marketing, it was great because all the local newspapers wrote about it, you know, wig mistress saves the show and all that kind of stuff. But it's a tough game. You're in work a lot and you're out of work a lot.
Yeah, and that's where the in-between jobs come in. Were there any particularly standout in-between jobs other than obviously dressing up as a giant cigarette and working at Walker's?
I've done lots of event management work, but I did in the early days. It was lots of promo jobs, like being a PR stunt for companies. We did one for Virgin. Virgin Internet, and they wanted to do something against BT Internet, so they got a load of us to dress as giant snails and slugs and be photographed underneath the BT tower, and it was freezing cold in the morning. I was just questioning my life, dressed as a giant slug, this like full-on bodysuit, on this cobble pavement outside the BT tower with, you know, loads of press journalists taking photos of us, going, smile more, can you give us a bit more, slug number two, smile a bit more to this camera, going... Wasn't what I had in mind. I was meant to be a regular on Corrie by this point. But I did that. I've done bar work. I worked at a place called Cafe Fish in the centre of London. I've done loads of bar work. I considered doing an OnlyFans account recently, but I thought I'm not the only person that's going to subscribe to that is myself. So I'm not going to do that. What else did I taught? I teach. I used to teach acting and singing and stuff as well. I mean, it's a huge variety of jobs that you do. I used to do children's parties. They were terrible. I used to teach at Stagecoach, where basically you paid to become a nanny, a babysitter for 6 hours while kids just shout at you and eat their sushi. I did it in Highgate, in Highgate, darling, where the kids had sushi and wanted to drink kombucha. So yeah, it's a plethora of jobs, really. Anything that pays the bill, I'm a prostitute for money, Giles, basically.
Yes. Well, that's what I was hoping we'd get to. I often find, especially when I talk to people who work in marketing, and it's one of those things that looking back, you can kind of identify more so than you do at the time. But lots of people I've spoken to in our industry have credited early roles with giving them, you know, lessons which have proved useful in their latter careers marketing, whether it's just because they're frontline and they're closer to consumers, or whether they're just a bit more, I don't know, the cold face of reality of what we do in marketing. Are there any jobs that have helped you in your acting profession?
I think they all have. I think a lot of the ones, particularly where we're doing silly stunts, I've done, you know, ones for the PR companies where you do guerrilla marketing, you know, you're doing guerrilla stunts where literally you're in a van and you have to jump out as dressed as whatever. We did one for the launch of Bruno on DVD and we were all dressed in these Bruno outfits, you know, the bright pink outfits with the little unitard and running across Tower Bridge, but of course without any permission at all. So we were just told, get out, run across Tower Bridge, get a quick photo and leg it back into the fucking van and get off as quickly as possible. So guerrilla marketing and getting the shot and doing it in it with as quickly as possible with spending as little money as possible. I help event manage those kind of things now. And I suppose what I've learned from all that is you just have to have balls to go, do you know what? I'm just going to do it. And those jobs where you feel like a bit of a twat, as long as you're big and you own it, you look like less of an idiot because people, you know, people just go, oh, well, they seem to have time or I get what they're doing. As long as you do anything with confidence, what's the thing that we're always told? Strong but wrong. No, if you're going wrong, do it strong. If you're doing it strong, it won't look as wrong. Do you know what I mean? Because you're doing everything with confidence. So I've totally learned that you can blag your way into anything. And also another thing that I've learned is you can get in pretty much anywhere if you get a lanyard around your neck and a high vis on and walk in with confidence. And it really works. Honestly, you just walk in and just nod to the security going, all right, mate. Yeah. All right, mate. Yeah. I'll just pop in up. I just did pop inside to see Sid or something. And they'll go, yeah. Not a problem.
It's amazing you say that. I think I've shared this story a few times that one of my favorite tutors I had at Kingston University, he was a wonderful photographer called Chris Draper. That was his secret of getting into places where he clearly did not have, you know, the right security credentials to be at. And he would just say, just wear a high vis. People don't question people in high vises. I love that. And if you do something wrong, again, reminds me of a jazz musician I know called Jake. And he always says the best jazz musicians, if they make a mistake, they make the same mistake two more times, so people feel like it's part of the actual song.
I love it. There's a story about Kenneth Branagh, good old Kenneth Branagh, who apparently he was in Henry V, or it was one of the Shakespeare ones, and he was on stage giving his what's the famous Henry V speech? Lend me your ears, or whatever it is. But he forgot what he was doing, so it was, ladies and gentlemen, lend me your ears. Da 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 da. Da-da-da-da-da. And then he found his back way into it. And apparently, the audience had no fucking idea. They were just like, it's really good. Because they were so involved in what was going on, they didn't even realise that it was going da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. So I've used that many times on stage. When you lose your place, you either just stand there with dignity and poise as though it looks like you're making a very dramatic pin to pause, or you just say something that sounds slightly relevant and hope for the best, and nobody will know. Do you know what I mean? You hope, anyway.
Yeah.
Bit more tricky to do.
Yeah. But they will now.
Yeah, they will now. Well, it's a bit more tricky to do when you're in a musical and there's a whole orchestra there, and that's slightly more tricky, but, you know, what can you do?
Yeah. It's amazing because that makes so much sense, but it must be, nodding back to your kind of early acting career, it must take so much time for most people to gain that type of confidence to do a Kenneth Branagh and wing it with confidence.
No.
It almost feels like people are set up to fail in their early acting years.
I think so, yeah. I think there's always that thing. Was it Jim Broadbent said that there's a fear, one of the biggest fears of an actor, and I suppose any creative or mark, you know, in any industry, but I suppose particularly in one where you're kind of your own business or your own brand, is that somebody's going to come up to you and go, you don't, I've figured you out. You don't know what you're doing, do you? you literally don't know what you're doing. You're just doing it hoping for the best. I mean, I don't think many people do, particularly, I don't know, actors, creatives. All we do is kind of do what we think is right, follow our instinct and hope for the best. But if somebody actually said, do you actually know what you're doing? I'd be like, well, I don't know. You kind of just hope that after a few years, you learn a bit of the technique and stuff. But a lot of it is just following your gut, you know?
Yeah. At what point did following your gut lead you to starting your West End producer persona? Was that like dipping your toe in the water of trying something? Because it started quite slow, but it didn't take long for it to really catch, right?
Yeah, well, I was doing Oliver at the Drury Lane. It was the one where, you know, they had the, you used to have those musical theatre contests on TV, and it was one that Jodie Prendrick won. So I was in that. It was good fun with Griff Rhys-Jones and a few others playing Fagin. And in the industry, it's a great industry. But there was a lot of, lots of rumblings in the West End of some people being, you know, pissed off with certain things that were going on, money and long hours on Sunday shows. And I thought, it's a shame because we're in this industry that's meant to be a bit fun. I mean, it's called putting on a play. All we're doing is playing. We're trying to, you know, we're wearing stupid costumes and, you know, shouting and looking stupid. I mean, obviously there's a craft to it, but at the end of the day, it is about putting enjoyment to the audience. Like we're hopefully having enjoyment as well. And I just felt a little bit down by everything. And then Twitter was very new. What they used to do is like Twitter takeovers, so that you log on and then you do a, hey, I'm Christian, I'm in the Oliver cast. This is what we get up to, a day in the life of somebody in the Oliver cast kind of thing. And then I was asked to do it once, and I remember thinking, oh, so maybe I could pretend to be somebody else and do this. And so I thought, why don't I just tweet as a producer and tweet some insider gossip, some insider knowledge, and vent some of my frustrations, but from the point of view of a producer about the industry. So I did. And then people started going, oh my God, Cameron McIntosh is on Twitter. Because a lot of things that I was tweeting was things, because I was in Oliver and I knew a lot of people who know the West End shows. Some of it was just gossip to begin with. And people were like, oh, it's Cameron or it's Andrew Lloyd Webber. So he got a bit of a following from a lot of actors. And I was, you know, just tweeting things about the industry, about what actors were in what, and some gossip about what shows might come up. But then things about how is West End producer? I've got to pay the actor playing the dog more than the bloody human actors. It's costing me a bloody arm and a leg. Am I dumb surprised? You know, it's dwindling, dear, you know. So I just used to tweet in that kind of voice as him. And then it kind of took off. And then he became known as a bit of a phantom tweeter. And then you know how when something starts, you don't expect it to become quite as big as it is. And it just started gaining a bit of momentum. And then people were talking about it. And I'd be backstage and people would go, have you heard about this West End producer guy? People reckon it's Cameron, is having a laugh, or people think it's Bill Kenwright or Andrew Lloyd Webber, and it's somebody on their team. And it's all good publicity for them. And I was going, yeah, it's crazy. It's fucking, that's mad, isn't it? All this stuff that they're tweeting. And then The Observer did an article about the phantom tweeter of the West End, who's tweeting all this insider gossip and how he's tweeting about how the industry can be quite all-consuming and people get, you know, people in the industry getting fed up and all this kind of stuff. And then from then, it really took off. Had a big following, and from there, you know, the shows and the books and everything just started coming, and I just kind of followed it, going, oh, this is interesting. Your West End producer became far more well known than stupid Ginger Christian Edwards, so that became kind of more of my identity for a while.
But that's interesting the way you phrase that, because did you see it as competition for Christian Edwards, or did you see it as validation for Christian Edwards?
I think it was probably a bit of both. I think it was I think it was nice to do something that was deemed successful, whatever you think success is. Do you know what I mean? But it was nice to do something that had a following. It was nice. Actually, it was nice to do something that seemed to be making a bit of a difference, because people were writing to me and people were responding, going, God, thank you for saying the truth. Thank you for being honest about how hard it is being in our industry. Thank you for voicing things that I can't voice. And because he was anonymous and incognito, I could tweet whatever I want. I could offend whoever I want. And I was very careful not to offend people. I kind of tried to do it with I tried to just dig at people, because I thought one day this is all going to come out and nobody's going to want to employ Christian Edwards as an actor. So I was very careful with how I offended people. But, you know, I had to be a little bit close to the bone, because it was satire. He was a satirical character taking the piss out of the industry, basically. So I think I did feel a bit of validation, because I, to be honest, I don't think I felt any validation as Christian Edwards. I was just somebody in a show. And I think by that point, I think I was just a bit disillusioned with the industry, because it's quite, I think what happens with a lot of actors, you know, and creatives, artists as a whole, is sometimes you only identify yourself as being successful when you're in work, and you only identify as being worthy when you're in work or working as an actor, because it can be hard sometimes. But yeah, when you're at parties or you go to family events or you're out and you go, this is Christian, someone met Christian, he's an actor. And they go, great. Have you done EastEnders? Have you been in The Bill? Yeah, what have I seen you in? Yeah, I recognise that. I recognise that nose. I'm sure. Have you been in? Yeah. And I'm like, oh, you know what I mean? Always having to, you kind of validate it yourself to others. So I was underneath it all, when I was asked those things, it was, do you know what? It was also good having the secret. It was also nice going, I don't care what you think about me. I've got this little secret. And it made me feel good. And it felt me like I was doing something undercover. And it was a little bit, somebody said when it all came out that he was like a Banksy of the theatre world, because he kind of went and he wrote his article, did all this stuff, did it totally undercover. Nobody knew who he was. Well, a few people did. And then he got a big reputation for being undercover. So I suppose it just made me feel like I had something, makes it sound really arrogant. It wasn't from arrogance. It was just kind of, like you say, validating myself. It made me feel like I had something over people. Is that the right thing to say? Do you know what I mean? It just made me feel like I had something. Whereas as an actor, a lot of times you have nothing. You're kind of, you know, you're in work, you're out of work, you're dressing as a fucking slug, you're dressing as a giant cigarette, or seeing your ex-fiance laughing at you while you're trying to make fucking 50 quid to pay the rent. And then, so you feel you don't have much control. And do you know what? Also, it was a creative outlet for me. It allowed me to be creative with the writing, with the books, and then creating him. And he became, do you know what? He became an acting job as well, because I'd go to events. I was forced to go to events as him as well. So I wore a fat suit and got the mask offline and got a wig, and you know, I lived in Southeast London, so I used to get the train from Southeast London with my little suitcase, because I was invited to, I did a talent show in the West End, and it was interesting on Twitter, because it really took off on Twitter. At one time somebody sent me a video of themselves singing. So I gave some feedback going something like, well, that was sung really well, dear. Just when you open your mouth, try not to look too much like a blow-up doll. Good, good, good. And then loads of other people started sending me videos. I had about 500 videos for the feedback. Yes, try and keep your, when you sing, try and keep your eyebrows still, dear. We don't want to be looking at those caterpillars above your eyes. You know, things like that. And then eventually I started being nice about the feedback, trying to actually offer some support. Then this casting director, Anne Vosser, then this musical director, Mike Dixon, started helping me, and this producer called, God, I've forgotten his name, please forgive me. We did an online contest, search for a Twitter star, and then we made it into a live final at the Lyric Theatre. We, you know, loads of West End stars performing. We did a live final where people voted via Twitter onto these live boards on stage. And of course, like a week before, I was like, fuck, I've got to turn up. I've got to turn up as West End producer. I can't turn as me. So I found a latex mask online. This wig mistress I knew got me a wig. I bought a suit from a charity shop and put a cushion under my belly. I stooped, put some gloves on, which you could tweet from. I did Bill Nighy hands, you know, where the little last two fingers are kind of bent in, and I stooped and I gave him an elderly voice. So I said, yeah, he was an old man, and gave him glasses, you see. And then I went to the theatre and wore that bloody fat suit for 8 hours watching the tech rehearsal and the dress rehearsal. It was like a steam room sauna thing. But yeah, that's how the character of him was invented. Well, it was forced upon me, and then I played him as an acting role, I suppose, for a good 12 years after the first two of just being online.
And I love how it evolved, obviously, from Twitter, where you have, you know, your very real character limitations, to then taking physical form. At any stage during that process, and that must have been, I mean, I've crudely summarized probably several years there, but at any stage there, did you feel like you wanted to tell people it was you, or were you kind of buying into the kind of myth around who the person was as much as everybody else, and enjoying that side of the mystery?
A bit of both. Sometimes I really wanted to tell people because people, I sometimes wanted to go say to people, do you know what? I'm this guy that's written these books or writes these articles and does this stuff. I'm not just Christian, this guy that's an actor and done a couple of shows. It was, and that was when it became a bit of a problem because I was more excited about West End producer's success than I was about mine. You know what you do in terms of marketing? I kind of literally, as an actor, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? You kind of become the brand. We are the brand. Really. And as West End producer, I kind of created this online brand, this idea, and then I literally became him as the character. I, you know, did the book signings, went to events, did radio interviews, did all that kind of stuff. And I suppose it made me feel, I felt successful as him. So when I was like speaking to people, sometimes I wanted to validate my own success and let people know, I'm not just an actor that's done a few shows. I've also written books and I've done this and I've created this character. And sometimes I wanted the validation, but most of the time it was kind of nice having the secret.
Yeah, and what I find really interesting when I first heard about it is that it's not just trivializing the role of an actor, but you're not just pretending to be someone else and doing it so well that you've got this huge growing audience and this kind of fascination into who the character is, but you kind of crafting it from the off as well. This, it's not like it was a character that pre-existed and you're stepping into the shoes of Oliver, for example. You're creating it from scratch and actually it's evolving. And then it has to, you know, manifest physically and attend things physically. And that just must have added to the speculation. And that I wonder when you first turned up in your mask and your gloves and everything else, did that almost nudge people towards thinking you definitely must be Lloyd Webber, for example?
Yeah, well, for some people, that's why. I mean, it was very clear that I was in a mask. It was a latex mask. I mean, a very well-known reviewer, critic, writer called Mark Shenton, he was at one of the press nights when I was at, and he was with this guy from America who turned around and said to him, "Oh, look at that poor man. He must have had a terrible car accident, but look at the horrible surgery that he's had." And Mark was like, no, that's West End producer, the person that nobody knows who it is. We think he's blah, 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 blah. So I think when people saw him, it went either ways. Some people thought, how would Cameron McIntosh or Andrew Lloyd Webber have the time to go to these events and get dressed up? But then other people went, God, this is a stroke of genius. If this is Cameron or Andrew Lloyd Webber or Bill Cameron or even Nika Burns, Sonia Friedman, it's fucking hysterical if they're doing this because they're ripping the shit out of the industry. There they are, other people's shows, dressed as this old man, taking the piss out of what they're watching and commenting on theatre and being able to market their own shows at the same time. Because this is what one of my friends who works in theatre marketing said to me as well. He said that whilst you were also publicising all these shows for free with your huge Twitter following, from the articles you were writing, that just by being there with the photos that you're doing, it was free publicity for all these shows. So that's why I got invited. And that's why some producers even sent me bottles of Dom Perignon to say thank you for. So I was very happy. So I got to go to all the Western shows and got some free bottles of Dom Perignon and stuff. But it was an interesting one. And it did keep evolving. You're absolutely right. I mean, it came to the stage where when I was doing the books, I had the radio interview and somebody was asking me as Western producer. So obviously I'd do whole interviews as him. I'd be out sometimes for 8 hours as Western producer talking like this, you see. And when people asked him about I remember somebody asked him about his history, how he got involved in theatre, and it just off the cuff, I was like, well, you see, my father was the first pantomime dame, and I was born backstage during a particularly bad production of My Fair Lady, where Eliza couldn't dance all night. So when I grew up, I decided I'm going to produce a really good version of My Fair Lady. So he just kind of came up with this stuff on the spot, and then I wrote it all down, and that became his biog, and that's how his voice, you know, dear, and the more I played him, the more he had a distinctive voice. The more I played him as well, I realized that he was a bit like an old actor friend of mine called Terry Soule, who I knew as a kid from working backstage at Lincoln, and then knew him in London as well. And he was an old actor who you'd go out to the Garrick Club or something, and he'd order his whiskey. And if the whiskey was given to him without any water, he would fucking lose it. I asked for water and I wanted it lukewarm. You've given me ice cold water. How long have I been a fucking member? All this kind of stuff. So I realized that he was a little bit of Western producer. But But yeah, so yeah, the brand did keep evolving. And then I got the idea of making musical theatre jackets. So I buy all these jackets from secondhand shred stores and then go around and get all these theatre programmes and brochures and then put them all up and then put them on all the jackets and stick them on. And so he'd go as a piece of like human fucking advertising. He'd be a human billboard of theatre. So I'd go to press nights as that, which was ridiculous. People would go, God, he's making his own bloody jackets now. And it would just be, you know, a piece of paper that had been crudely cut up and stuck onto the jackets. But it looked quite good, actually.
Yeah. And do you think it helped the industry take itself less seriously?
Well, do you know what? I like to think so. When I came out with it last year, I think lots of people said with the consistency of it and the fact that he did all the stage articles, it was like an agony column. So people would write to him asking for advice. He did offer, underneath all the truth and the comedy, I suppose, there was truth about how to be in the industry and mental health and all this stuff. He was, you know, I talked to him as a person. I mean, he was somebody who advocated mental health. He wanted to help people. I think he just said a lot of the truth that people didn't dare say before, which allowed people to go, oh, yeah, I think people did reflect more. And another writer at the stage, a producer, and Wright said that he'll miss, and it was really nice because it really, because sometimes I question, if I'm honest with you, I go, what have I done that for 14 years of my life, or what have I got from it actually? Yeah, it was nice to do the books and the videos and the reviews and the articles and the contests and all that stuff was great, and I took a show to Edinburgh Festival, that was all great, but I kind of think, but it's just led to me just going, I've done that now.
Time, weather, and
we interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
My first sort of proper paid weekly job was a holiday job as a student, which was driving a forklift truck at the Ribena factory.
Ah, Call to Action, episode 11, with the one and only Rory Sutherland. Not what we were looking for, but hang on a minute. Ah, there we go.
Given that you dedicated yourself to the topic of mental health and you spoke with an honesty that perhaps didn't really exist or wasn't as accessible, the people who needed to hear it probably benefited at a scale that I imagine quite difficult for you to even see or realise. So it's almost as if you were kind of hidden from the amazing effects you must have had. And then obviously in unmasking, people might interpret that as the end of this voice that they relied upon. But also no one can judge whether it was the right or wrong time for you to unmask. Because as you say, you dedicated 14 years to it. It must have been hugely therapeutic, not just for you, but for everyone else involved who needed to hear that voice.
Yeah. It's an interesting point. I mean, since I've come out with it, there's been lots of people have emails because, you know, he's got an email address and said thank you. And people that, like when I did the Twitter contest, the live final, there's loads of actors in the industry now that were in that, you know, working in the West End, saying it was the first chance that we had to perform in the West End. So thank you for giving us that opportunity. And I was out a few weeks ago and he came up to me and it was so nice. He went, I'm a bit starstruck. I was like, what do you mean? Why? And he went, just found out you're a West End producer. And I've read your books through drama school. I did all this. I read all the articles. I can't believe it's you. And you're, I thought it was an old man. And when it came out, I couldn't believe it. And now you're here. Can you sign this? And I was like, and it was just, you know, it's really nice. Not that you need validation, but it is nice to know he made a difference. Because I, as myself, I ran a peer-to-peer support group with my mate Harry about mental health, actually, called Talk, for a few years. So there was a little bit of a cross section between, because I think in any industry it's very tricky, and particularly I think in the acting industry it's tricky to, you don't want to be labelled as somebody with depression or anxiety or that kind of stuff, because you want to be able to be somebody that's employed all the time, but it's a very hard thing to talk about. So he did broach those subjects. So it was nice when people said that to him. It gave the whole thing a bit of validation. And it was good fun. Do you know what I mean? It was good fun. And at the end, I just had to go. It was the right time for me to stop doing it. And it was becoming a bit of a question about, am I just going to keep playing West End producer forever? Or am I going to have to dedicate some time and do my own projects? I just remember I went to one press night and I was on the train and I got changed at the public toilets at Charing Cross Station and it fucking stank. And there I was putting my outfit on and stank of shit, and I put the latex mask on, and the stink got in, you know, in the latex mask. So I was watching, I forget what show it was, but all I could smell was the shitty toilets from Charing Cross Station for the whole evening. Nearly vomited in my mask at the end of the night. And I thought, you know what, maybe it's time to take a break. and also it did take over a bit. And because, as I say, I think sometimes he got invited to a lot of stuff, and sometimes I felt more successful as him, as me, for my own mental health.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. And I don't think anyone can say whether it was right or wrong other than you. And you know, kudos to you, not only for giving a voice to so many people who needed a voice, but also saying what needed to be heard. It's a fascinating thing. Did you feel like it was a type of typecasting? Now, obviously, actors are known for their parts more so than they are as individuals, I suppose, which must be one of the kind of weird things that actors have to juggle when it comes to any toll it takes on your mental health. Like, are you this actor or are you this part? Did it feel like the right time for you to kind of retire it and look at other projects and creative outlets?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think I'd, as I say, validated myself and spent so long, I was turning acting work down to make sure that he was in London to carry on doing his articles, to write his books. And I just kind of thought, because I was putting so much energy to, you know, to wish him producer. I mean, I had a fucking half of my wardrobe was his costumes. And I'm like, listen, I remember one of my exes going, are you getting paid? Are you making lots of money from this? And I was like, oh, no, I make money from the books and the articles, but not a lot. And she was like, okay, so why are you still doing it? And I think that kind of hit home a bit, going, well, yeah, that's a good point, really. Why am I still doing it? Because sometimes you can get carried away, can't you, and just kind of carry on doing something because it feels good and successful. It made me reevaluate a little bit, I suppose. Since I've left him, he's still there. I didn't kill him off. A friend, do you know Mark Bukowski? You must know Mark. Do you know Mark? He's
I do. Yeah. He kindly supported a mental health initiative that I started during the pandemic called Isolated Talks.
Oh, brilliant! That's great. Yeah, Mark would. He's great. But he reached out to me when I was doing West End Producers, saying at one point he said, "What you've done in theatre, creating a character like that, and influencing and getting into the middle of theatre and managing to turn it on its head," he said, "it's something I've been trying to do for years, and here you come along and do it. It was really nice." And then so I spoke to him a lot, and he gave me some advice when I was doing worse than much. So he was, you know, he was somebody great to talk to. I really admired. And he, when I was talking to him about coming out of it, he very rightly said, "Well, don't kill him off. Don't kill him off. Just say he's going to go on break for a bit." And he was right, because I didn't want him dead. I was going to say he was watching the film version of Les Mis and he had a heart attack watching Russell Crowe's depiction. Yeah, you're not a singer, Russell. Come on, honestly, dear. But a great actor. Yeah, so I was going to say that he'd had a heart attack watching that, but then it does make more sense to say he's gone on a bit of a break. And then also I'm trying to develop him for TV. We're looking at him might be playing a comedy character, because he's a bit like Mrs. Merton. He says things that other people can't. You know what I mean? Or just doing a little documentary about the whole thing, because it's just a fucking weird, ridiculous, quintessentially British thing, isn't it? You know, that weird thing that Brits people do sometimes, the silly comedy things that they do. So yeah, it was just the right thing to do, and now I don't wear latex very much in my own personal life, you'll be pleased to know. So yeah.
one of the other kind of parallels I think I've made between you and this role and other creatives of all shapes and sizes that we've had on is that need for additional creative outlets.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful advertising creative, Mark Denton, was on recently, our last show.
I listened to the podcast.
He's
not
only renowned.
Yeah, he's brilliant. I listened to that.
He's wonderful. Yeah, and great. Well, thank you. And he's so known for his work outside advertising as much as he is inside, and a huge advocate for, you know, being able to kind of flex that creative muscle just everywhere, you know, everywhere you kind of exist and however it might manifest.
Yeah.
Is that something that you kind of realized at the time, or looking back, you think was significant to yourself as a creative, as an artist?
Yeah, I didn't realize it at the time, but it was you're absolutely spot on, Giles. It's that thing of going, you need, you know, as somebody who it's part of your makeup, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? You need an outlet. You need, and when I don't, I'm one of those kind of people, a little bit all over the place, a little bit ADHD, who has, as I think a lot of like actors, creative people are, that I have to have projects ongoing. Otherwise, I sometimes just, if I'm honest with you, sometimes feel, what's the point? What am I doing? What am I doing in my life? Particularly as an actor, you rely on other people to give you the work. You really do rely on another company, a director, a producer to give you a chance. But I think it took me a long time to realize that you have to give yourself permission to do that. You have to give yourself permission to create your own work and write. And even if you're not doing it for success, you're just doing it for your soul. And I think that's what West End Producer was.
Yeah.
It's exactly what he was. It was just a reaction to me being a bit fucked off, a bit bored, creatively stifled. It was a release, you know, which is why it carried on. And then it's that thing, isn't it? When something's...
Was it therapeutic?
Absolutely, 100%. 100%. Because I was able to say what I was feeling inside. So it was like me, maybe, it's weird, maybe West End Producer was a bit like my therapist because I was able to talk through him, which is an interesting thought. But I was able to get out my inner frustrations about what I was feeling as an actor who wasn't, wasn't doing very well. I was able to tweet about how frustrating it was and get him to tweet how he treats actors and how actors should behave and all this stuff. So it was really therapeutic for me.
Would you like to plug any other projects you have coming up before we move to list of questions? What's next?
I was asked to do another book of him, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'm working on a couple of little, developing him for TV and a couple of other little TV projects. And I'm also in at the moment working with my very dear friend Elizabeth Newman. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, Giles, I'm currently not stuck, I'm in Pitlochry in Perthshire, surrounded by the beautiful hills. I'm rehearsing The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Bloody Music, dear. Yes, I'm up in Scotland doing this with a brilliant cast and company until Christmas. So the aim is to move to LA next year for possibly a year, because I've got relatives over there, and I had a few meetings over there last year. And I love the sun. I get a bit down when it's so grey. I find it quite tricky. That seasonal affective disorder, that bloody thing. So that's all I'm doing at the moment. But if anybody's involved in the theatre industry or the acting industry or goes to the theatre a lot, my books are still available, and I don't have any Don Perignon at the moment. So I'd love to be able to afford some for Christmas.
Amazing. Well, those books are linked to in this listing, so they don't have to look far for them. I'm going to go to listener questions now. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. I'm going to start with Hannah Lean, who's the marketing director of ABBA Voyage. Hannah asks, given that the acting industry relies heavily on self-promotion and marketing, particularly through social media, how effectively do acting schools equip their graduates with the skills to market themselves and build a personal brand in the wider world?
Well, speaking of somebody who hasn't really been in the drama school for a long time, Hannah Lean was in my year at Mountview. How funny. It's that Hannah Lean. Good old Hannah. Oh, Hannah. I'll miss you. Bless you. I would say they don't at all. I don't think they do. I don't. When I was at drama school, we're going back to 1942. We weren't even talk about tax. We weren't talk about how to deal with the mental health issues of being in and out of work. So I sometimes go back and teach at drama schools, but I don't think it's something that is talked about at all. I mean, it's really interesting as an actor now. We have these tools which help us sell our brand, and I think there's a right way of doing it and there's a wrong way of doing it. I think you can be too earnest. You know, when you see people going, I'm so thrilled to announce and blah, 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 blah. And it becomes I think you have to be careful. Think about who you are aiming it at as well. And I think there are do's and don'ts as well about social media. You've got to be careful. You have to think about what you're going to tweet. Don't do it at midnight after you've had a few too many ciders. There's the whole thing about, should we use Twitter? Should it be Instagram? Should it be, use TikTok? At auditions, I know, a lot of producers, and one's a very good friend who says to me, they check people's social media accounts. Because if it's down to somebody with 10 Instagram followers and somebody with 25,000, they're going to give it to the one with 25,000. It's something that can really be worked on. And I think it's sad that that's become really important. But I mean, it's the way of the world, isn't it? I think the way of doing it is just being consistent on social media. If it's something that's really important to you. But also, there's a bit of me that's a bit traditional and goes, you shouldn't be forced to do something like that. If you're a really good actor, if you're perfect for the part, that I kind of still think, in the long run, you're going to succeed without social media. It's what I'd like to think. There's the worry, isn't there, that people feel like they have to do social media accounts now, you know? So I think it's about getting the getting the balance right, perhaps. I don't know. I see people, some people put up audition tapes. I see people put up audition tapes, people put up people and sing it. And that's great. But I suppose if you start doing it and you start getting a bit of a following and an audience who like what you're doing, then that's it. It's working, isn't it? So maybe my advice is it's trial and error. Try a few different things, and if one fits and one starts working, that's your way. That's what's working for you, maybe.
I spoke to someone who's become one of my favourite people, Tim Plester, a few months ago. Tim's a filmmaker, documentary maker, actor, and he made the point, I'm sure it was Tim, that in many ways social media has allowed certain media to become much more accessible than it was when he was first getting started, where to actually get any type of video footage of you acting in the hands of the right people was you know, nigh on impossible, if not costly and you know, therefore prohibitive. So in many ways, that accessibility is amazing to have that available. But I suppose then the challenge then becomes doing it for the sake of doing it, which is what you were kind of hinting at there, where people feel maybe obliged to be on social media, or doing versus doing something actually creative and memorable and distinct on social media, which is, you know, the challenge that everybody faces. You know, how do you actually stand out and build an audience? It's almost like a stage in its own right, I suppose. I'm a huge fan of stand-up comedy, and prior to having kids, my wife and I used to go and see stand-up, you know, almost weekly. And I was talking to someone about emerging kind of comedians on the scene nowadays, making the point that lots of them don't really do the traditional circuits like they might have done a few decades ago, because you might find comedians that only exist on TikTok or only exist on Instagram, and they've got these huge followings and they're probably monetizing it very successfully, but it doesn't mean you're going to see them at a stage near to you anytime soon, because they almost don't need the stage there anymore because they've got this, you know, online version of it.
Yeah, that's
very fragmented.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? It's fragmented. I mean, and going up on what you're saying, I think if you do have an idea, I think don't be afraid what people think. I think there's the initial fear, isn't it, of putting stuff out there and worrying about what others will think, particularly on social media and what. So, you know, if you do have the thing, people. But I was speaking to my mate, Sharon Digsworth, here in Scotland, the other night, and we were saying the interesting thing that we find about social media, if you as an actor, I think, you know, the old movie stars back in the day, none of them had social media, and I think that made them in a weird way be able to be better actors, because you didn't know who their dog was, you didn't know that they liked to eat ice cream at 1 o'clock in the morning, you didn't know what their original accent was, you didn't know everything fucking about them. All you knew is this brilliant magic persona of them on screen or in the theater, which kind of actually made them as actors more adaptable. Do you get me? Because it wasn't just about who they were as people. But I suppose what the balance has changed now is that audiences and people want to know the people, don't they? And that becomes just as important as creating the roles. It's an interesting one, isn't it? About whether audiences come to see you doing a great performance or they just come to see you.
Yeah, for sure. Question two is from Joseph. Joseph asks, in the world of social media influencers, you could be considered as one of the first. Have you ever considered yourself as part of that industry?
It's funny, I only ever considered that when I came out with it and somebody said to me, you were like one of the first influencers. And in fact, Stuart, you know, who works with you, said that to me, you were one of the first that comes out of it. And I never considered myself as to be an influencer, because my idea of an influencer used to be, you know, people, very good looking people with loads of Botox, wonderful sculpted bodies, hanging around pools and drinking fucking free drinks in Dubai or something. And that was what the influencers seemed to be. So that gave influencers a really bad name. But I think that is starting to change now, isn't it? Where you have influencers who are like on social media, I follow all these brilliant people about, you know, healthy food and fitness and all this kind of stuff. And they're influencers now. So I think the term influencer is starting to change. I think it used to have a bad reputation because of these people in Dubai. And I'm not saying if you're in Dubai and you're an influencer, you're a bad person. I bet you're lovely and you've got great lips. So you carry on doing what you're doing. There's other influencers now that are valid and are really good for people's live mental health advocates, people who and you know, a lot of well-known, you know, doctors and specialists in their fields are now influencers, and they're getting book deals out of it. So I think now the tide has turned. So I think in retrospect, yes, he probably was one of the first influencers, but to a lesser extent, because he was just on Twitter. West End Producers on Instagram now, but he was literally just on Twitter before it turned into X, and he was well, he's still on X, obviously, but it was a smaller field, wasn't it, back then? And he got to, what did he get to do? At some point, 100,000 followers. It was all around there. But yeah, he was doing it before it became a thing. So it seemed more innocent, I suppose. I suppose in the past, when I speak to my, you know, nephew and niece, and you hear young kids saying they want to be an influencer, that I suppose that used to make me go, oh, God, people want to be an influencer. But then the people I admire are influencers who are masters at their game, or are specialists who are then also influencers. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. It's not like a means to an end, I suppose. You become, you know, you're brilliant in a certain field or followed in a certain field, therefore you have influence. You don't start off saying, I want to be an influencer, and then work out
what the
topic is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in answer to your question, I think now I look back and go, yeah, probably he was, but before it even existed, yes. Weird. It's very weird.
Yeah. And it wasn't a pool in Dubai, squatting
no,
in leotard.
It was sadly. It was a fucking pool in bloody Butlins. Oh, I actually did. No, actually, funnily enough, I did this cruise. I have to tell you, I did this cruise called, they do Stages Cruise, which is musical theatre. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Oh.
I didn't know whether to bring this up.
Oh,
but go on.
My God. It's basically a cruise ship full of the biggest West End lovers, and they think Michael Ball is a god. And you have all these musical theatre performers on there. And I went on there as West End producer, just walked around, you did the odd interview here and there. Did it the first year. Then I was asked to go back the second year. But he was treated a bit of an influencer there because people knew who he was and everything. But I did a show at Edinburgh. And I have to tell you this to just say how you just get the interest, you know, how, you know, you have highs and you have fucking lows, Giles. You have lows. So I did a show at Edinburgh, which was good fun. I enjoyed it. And it went down well at Edinburgh, but it was a show for an intimate venue. And then I went on this Stages cruise ship where you were woken up every morning with John Barrowman singing, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, into your bed frame, whether you liked it or not. And you went, Jesus Christ, I'm getting over my gins this morning and here's fucking John Barrowman waking me up. Jesus. So I was asked to do my show on this cruise ship by one of the producers who put some money in for my show to go to Edinburgh. So I said, of course. So it turned up and then they said, we think we're going to put it on the main stage. Just because, you know, you get more of an audience. And I literally, at the time, I was like, ah, but it's small, it's more of an intimate show. I'm not sure it's going to work on there. And they said, no, trust us. It's going to be fine. So I was like, okay. By this point, I was shitting myself. I knew it was the wrong thing to do. So before me, there was Alfie Bowe giving his all, him and his huge orchestra. Then there was Sheridan Smith singing all her greatest hits. I mean, hugely brilliant Sheridan Smith and the dancers and everything. And then there was me, West End producer, doing the show after those two, jumping onto stage on an inflatable whale, singing songs on my own piano, taking the piss out of Michael Ball and John Barrowman, singing songs like my Willy Whale, the best friend a boy can have. Are you going to help me, ladies and gentlemen, find the leading actor to be my free Willy Whale? Yes. And it was a Mickey take out of musical theatre, and it was me trying to find the leading actor for my aquatic-based water musical that was going to happen underneath the Thames, and we were looking for somebody to play the leading whale. And nobody got it. And I looked out front and I saw people standing up and walking out in droves. All these old dears going, because there was a bit of swearing in it, walking out. And I was going, fuck. So in my mind, I just tried to cut through it. It was awful. And underneath, one moment in like 30 minutes into it, I could just feel this little tear going down underneath the mask as I thought, oh my God. It was one of the worst moments. I came off stage, I took the mask off and I threw it on the floor and I jumped up and down on it. And I thought, that's it. I can't do this again. It was honestly, it was the most humiliating, embarrassing moment in my life.
Yes. Well, I mean, sometimes people are just not your audience, right? There's a lesson there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The final part of the interview then, Christian, is our four pertinent poses, starting with what advice would you give to your younger self?
Eat more fiber. Lots of veg. Because you didn't start doing that till you were a bit older. So you need your veg. Don't get engaged to that woman who didn't actually marry you. Don't do that. Cause it's a waste of 5 years. Also, don't let fear stop you doing stuff. Don't let what other people think of you stop you doing stuff as well. Because I've stopped myself doing lots of things because people have said it's not the right thing to do and blah, 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 blah. And I've always thought it might affect my reputation if I do that. But you kind of just have to follow your own instinct, don't you? And I suppose that's what the great... And I'm not saying I'm a great artist at all, but I mean, people I really admire, they've got a voice of their own and they've just done it. And whether people have liked it or they haven't, it's those people that get the respect because they've had an individual view of the world, I suppose. So I would say to myself, if you've got an idea, do it. And don't just rely on other people to give you work. I'd say more so on that. Only do work because you think it's going to be good for your CV. Do work because it's good for your soul. If you think something's going to make you happy, do it. You know.
Yeah. I think wasn't there? I'm having flashbacks to seeing an interview with, I think it was Michael Caine. Didn't he famously say he just would say yes to roles that were offered to him, even if they, you know, at first glance, and I'm paraphrasing here, looked a bit batshit crazy.
Yeah.
Because he ended up doing like Jaws 4 and all sorts of things. And he says that every now and then, one of them just turns into gold.
Yeah.
You just got to say yes to things.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's slightly different for him doing the big movies as well, because that allows him to have another extension of his beautiful kitchen. Whereas doing an equity minimum tour doesn't have quite the same kind of draw. Do you know what I mean?
New toaster.
Yeah, exactly. But one thing, actually, that's another piece of advice. Actually, honestly, it's good to say no. If you're not sure about something, say no. That's one of the only powers you have as an actor, saying no to work. And I think we can spend a lot of our lives as actors, as creatives, trying to please other people, whether it be our agent, whether it be the certain casting director, whether it being, other people that we know. And you end up floating from job to job to job to job to job. And before you know it, that's 10 years gone. You've gone, actually, what the fuck about? I've just floated, but I haven't actually made a decision. I haven't decided what kind of actor I want to be. And I think it's important at some point to go, no, this is the kind of work I want to do. This is the kind of work that I admire. This is the kind of work that I want to do. I might be out of work for longer periods, but fuck it. I'm going to wait and I'm going to do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well said. Yeah, really good advice that. Number two, if you could banish one thing from your industry, what would it be and why?
I would banish the idea that if you reach out to people directly, that you're desperate. I think there's an idea these days, particularly for actors, that if you're reaching out to people, if you're sending emails, if you're doing all this stuff, you're desperate, that it should just be left to your agent, that it should be. But I'd want to get rid of that idea. I think somebody trying to reach out to people themselves, if not desperation, it just shows somebody that's willing to try and find their own work, you know, find their own success. So maybe it's getting rid of that, getting rid of a myth about what desperation is. Also, false promises. When you see organisations that go, actually, it's interesting that you've talked about mental health. There's lots of companies, not just in my sector, in others, that will go, we're doing this new mental health flagship thing and we have a mental health person working for us. When it's fashionable to do so. But then when you actually see what's happened a couple of years down the line, those people don't even exist anymore. So... I would banish people who make false promises because it looks fashionable to do so at the time.
Yeah. Oh, there's plenty of that in our world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They issue a press release about some intention to do something and then it just fizzles out.
Yeah, exactly.
Number three, are there any books you could recommend to our listeners? Are you a reader?
I'm a reader, yeah. I mean, but about acting or about anything?
Anything. Can be either or.
Right.
Or both.
I love ultra-processed people at the moment. It's about how we, I forget the name, it's Chris somebody or other, ultra-processed people. It's about basically how we eat basically about 60% ultra-processed diet and how they're saying that's now been directly linked to major health issues that we all have in our society. Because most of our food is packaged, because most of us are so busy, like, you know, you're in your office, like I'm at rehearsals and stuff, so you go and grab a quick sandwich. But the sandwich is just ultra-processed food. If you stop at a garage up and down the country, all you can have is ultra-processed food. So they're talking about how all this stuff that is ultra-processed that we're putting into our bodies is actually killing us, which is why the rates of cancer and all this stuff is soaring at the moment. Really interesting. As an actor thing, read, if you're interested in acting, Anthony Sher, Year of the King. It's a brilliant journal about an actor getting into the roots and the core of acting and how it is to be in an acting company. I'd also say Kenneth Branagh's book on that as well. And purely kind of like mental health-wise, I love Johan Hari's book, Lost Connections. It's an amazing book about depression and how his idea is that it's about the fact that we're lost, and actually talking about social media, that we spend so much time talking through a laptop, and how society post-COVID has pushed us probably 10 years ahead in our use of social media and digital media, that our brains can't really deal with it. And we're not looking at people in the eyes, so we're not actually having those kind of those chemical reactions. Yeah, my nephews and nieces, the amount of time that you know, is spent online and on social media and on Twitter and talking on Snapchat and on TikTok. And I get it, because in one respect, it's great. So I can see it's good because kids are communicating that way. So there is a friendship developing. But from that, you can also have online bullying, cyberbullying. You just lose the element of play like we did when we were kids, being outside and just, you know, just being with somebody else, being with another human, something that I worry we're losing the capacity to do. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, more than I can articulate. I've had huge concerns about that for a while. In fact, going back to your point on eye contact, during the pandemic, I actually bought, it was a Kickstarter project in the US, but it was effectively a webcam that you could dangle down on your screen so I could marry it up to faces in order to try and maintain eye contact, because I really struggled doing video calls.
Did it help?
It massively helped. Yeah, massively helped me. I mean, obviously the people on the other side have no idea, but I suspect that to them it looked at least that we were maintaining eye contact.
It's really,
I do think that's important, and I notice it myself. I mean, I've got 8 nieces of varying ages from 3 to 26, and you can see the effect it's had on all sorts of people. You know, that we come across. Just the kind of real life social skills that haven't perhaps had a chance to develop.
Yeah, I find it. I don't know if you get this as well. That my focus at the moment is everywhere. And I kind of, like, because of Twitter, because, you know, you do the quick things and you put it out and you want instant results. Like, if I'm reading, it takes me a while to get back into reading. I found lines, like I'm learning lines at the moment. It's taking me, obviously I'm older, you know, older than I used to be, but for them to settle in and for me to get focused on these things, it takes me so much more time, because usually I'm online and I'll quickly skip through the Guardian's, find out full of one. Seen that, okay, move on. So you quickly skip, you scroll, get your bit of info and then move on. Whereas the actual act of sitting down and focusing and reading, it's such a beautiful thing that I think we're forgetting how to do. I certainly am. I'm forgetting how to do it properly, and I have to kind of relearn. It's mad.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a problem that most people face. I think I heard it described as having too many tabs open in your brain. Which I think I certainly...
Honestly, if you saw my laptop now, honestly, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. There's another 20 there. There's 40. There's about 65 tabs open at the top of Google Chrome. Ridiculous. Why have I done it?
It's not healthy.
No, my ex was always like, what's that? She's like, why have you got? And I'm like, well, I might need to check that Octopus Energy one and that Amazon thing. And then that one there, Canva, I might use. And that one there, these are all things of Stage. IMDb Pro, there's my HMRS thing. There's, I don't know what that one is. And that looks like it might be OnlyFans. But you know what I mean? There's loads of tabs open anyway.
Yeah. Amazing. We always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest, who has to give the reason why. So would you dedicate this episode to somebody?
Yeah, I'd like to dedicate this episode to... I used to, when I was a drama scholar, I used to look after a couple who had a severe cerebral palsy called John and Yvonne. And I was always massively humbled by them. And they wanted actors to look after them because they wanted people with, you know, care, you know, they just had a bad spate of people looking after them. So they wanted people who could make them laugh. And it was amazing. I used to feed John. I used to wipe his bum. I even had to push his bloody piles back in one time. It was crazy, the amount of things I had to do. But they were so brilliant. And they always used to say to me, do what you do. They said, do what you be an actor, follow your dreams, do what you want to do, and don't let anybody put you off. And it really, I found it so moving. One time he used to try and push me in the bath. To give you an example, sometimes Yvonne would be, I'd have to wheel her in and she'd be washing herself in the bathroom, and John would be in the main room with me, and he'd put his little headset on and he'd tell me to turn on channel 289. So I'd turn on channel 289, I'd get him a whiskey and a Coke. I'd get myself a whiskey and Coke, and we'd sit there and watch this porn channel that he'd subscribed to. And then there he was, and he'd just nudge me and look at me smiling. And then Yvonne would go, Christian, and then I'd go and get Yvonne, and then John would kind of convulse a little bit, and I'd turn the channel over, then I'd bring Yvonne back in, and she'd be like, what have you been watching? I'd go, oh, just been watching the news, just thinking of politics, haven't you, John? And it was brilliant. And one night when I put them to bed, John looked at me, and he said, you remind me of Roy Castle, you know, on his little thing. He said, you make me laugh as much as Roy Castle. And it was such a nice thing. Do you remember Roy Castle? from record breakers and all that stuff. And I was just like, such a nice thing to say. And he always used to be just, you know, just keep doing what you're doing and you know, make yourself happy and try and make others happy. You know, if these people who have had so much against them had such a wonderful life, it just, I sometimes think of them. And when I get annoyed at myself, I just kind of get, you know what? I'm fucking lucky. I'm fucking lucky.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely story and a wonderful dedication. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to John and Yvonne. Amazing. As a final call to action, everyone listening can head over to the listing. We will share links to everything we've discussed, to the books, Ultra Processed People, Year of the King, Lost Connections, West End Producer, albeit the Twitter profile's on a bit of a vacation at the moment. How else can our listeners get more Christian Edwards?
Well, I'm on Insta as Christian Edwards 1 and on X as Chris Edwards 79. West End Producer's got a website called westendproducer.org.
Amazing. Well, we'll link to all of those. Listen, Christian, thank you so much for joining us. I've enjoyed this immensely.
Yeah, same. Thanks so much, Giles. It's been great. It's also nice. You're Edwards. So am I. I mean, maybe we're distantly related. You know what I mean? Maybe. Who knows?
I think we all are. I think that's how it works. I think we must be.
Yeah, exactly.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can just email the mouthful that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.